The members of the Second Continental Congress were men of status and wealth, men who in normal circumstances might be expected to shrink from the very word rebellion and seek shelter under the comforting mantle of established authority. Yet, in 1776, these men, successful lawyers, merchants, ministers and plantation owners, and a sprinkling of artisans, signed their names to one of the most revolutionary documents of modern times, in which they pledged to each other, our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, in the cause of American independence and the seemingly chaotic ideal that all men are created equal. Thus was the United States of America born, not a nation at first, but a loosely knit confederation brought together by common dissatisfactions and shared inspirations.
These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he who stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Heaven knows how to put a proper price upon its goods, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated. Britain, with an army to enforce her tyranny, has declared that she has a right not only to tax, but to bind us in all cases whatsoever. And if being bound in that manner is not slavery, then there is not such a thing as slavery upon earth. For so unlimited a power can only belong to God.
These are indeed the times that try men's souls. Like Paine, we are confronted with the increasing ruthlessness of power and tyranny of unlimited government. At all levels, government has extended its reach far beyond any authority granted to it, and with few exceptions, all are affected by it on a daily basis. The exercise of our individual liberties has all but been totally restricted. Not now by a foreign king, but by a government of men and women who have presumed for themselves the same authority once presumed by King George. Driven by greed or self-supposed importance, politicians and power brokers who know little of restraint nor loyalty think themselves able to enact any measure whatsoever into law with no regard to constitutional guideline or care for the effect upon the lives of we the people. These small men seek by these measures to bind us in all cases whatsoever, just as that former tyrant and his followers did well over two centuries ago. And because these modern tyrants attempt to exercise the same prerogatives with the same object and intent, we find that those same grievances listed against that first tyrant in the Declaration of Independence fit the modern tyranny like a vast historical mirror. He has obstructed the administration of justice. He has made judges dependent upon his will alone. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to our Constitution, for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by mock trial for many murders which they should commit upon the inhabitants of these states, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us, in many cases, of the benefits of trial by jury, for abolishing the free system of English laws, for establishing an arbitrary government, for abolishing our most valuable laws and altering fundamentally the forms of our government, and for declaring themselves invested with powers to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. Today, American government has distinguished itself as having the same character as that same unjust king. In order to search out new subjects for their king, they obstruct the simplest of justice by sending forth swarms of officers whose sole function appears to be to harass us, to eat out our substance, and to destroy our lives by the restriction and elimination of our liberties.
The confrontation was not created by the police. The confrontation was created by the people who charged the police. Gentlemen, get the thing straight once and for all. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
Mayor Richard J. Daley, Chicago, Illinois, August 1968. Through international agreements, both public and in secret, United Nations treaties, and a host of other arrangements such as GATT and NAFTA, we are indeed subjected to jurisdictions foreign and repugnant to our Constitution. These are enforced by large bodies of armed troops, police, and military, in addition to so-called laws, which allow them to further deprive us of our property, trial by jury or otherwise, and which have over time completely altered fundamentally the forms of a government. For example, we need only look at the closed American factories and the loss of meaningful jobs for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans since the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement. The citizens of this nation have now become subject to loss of life, liberty, and property at the hands of the very government once established to protect the essentials of free men. Yet the agents of government who in fact commit these crimes against innocent, peaceable men are protected from punishment through mock trials, which are offered in the form of political hearings without fear of reprisal or criminal prosecution. As regards the deaths of Sam and Vicky Weaver so many years after their murders, as of this writing, consider the injustice of lack of trial against accused government agent Lon Horiuchi. Taxation is now imposed illegally, without limit or consent, against the American people. Nearly 39% of the family income is paid out to government, federal, state, county, etc. This does not necessarily include sales tax on goods purchased. This total is greater than that of car payments, mortgage, and food costs combined for each family affected. But the more pervasive and hidden taxes upon our production, our innovation, job creation, and standard of living, all of which results from a corrupted and debased currency, and that has created a much bigger problem. Because our current monetary system only comes into existence in the form of debt. The more productive we become, the further into debt we in fact fall. And if we were to cease our production and collected all the currency in circulation, we could never pay the previous debt, because the currency to cover the imagined interest has yet to be printed and never will be. Consider this crash course in Economics 101. The U.S. Treasury Department prints our currency at a cost of less than 4 cents per bill, no matter what the denomination, which is then sold to the privately owned Federal Reserve Bank for no more than the cost of paper, printing, and ink. 4 cents per bill, at which time the Fed loans it back to us at full face value, plus interest. Oh, the debt is quite imaginary. But the production by Americans, one and all, is real and enjoyed with relish by these international banksters. By their methods of debt and usury, as yet unborn generations of American children have already been committed to enslavement, to be born into bonded servitude. And if bound in that manner is not slavery, then there is not such a thing as slavery upon this earth.
As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
President Dwight D. Eisenhower, Washington, D.C., January 1961. Under their controls, the clearest of constitutional guarantees are ignored or perverted to meet a desired end. Consider the Second Amendment of our Bill of Rights, which states, "The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." It has received numerous interpretations in these past several decades, but it does not mean that those rights shall not be infringed. Meanwhile, the Internal Revenue Service, on behalf of its parent, the Federal Reserve Bank, continues to collect taxes with no constitutional authority to do so within the 50 states, while the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms prevents child abuse in Texas by gassing and burning to death the victims of the alleged abuse. Our own military has assisted in these crimes in clear violation of the law, and once again, the persons committing these persecutions are protected from criminal prosecution. Some have even been rewarded for a job well done. Politicians of all parties, along with assistance from their media accomplices, while purporting to be acting on behalf of the welfare of the people of our great nation, hold contrasting positions with great reason and deliberation, each while enjoying membership in private, elitist organizations with age-old, well-defined agendae. While the media deftly creates, the politicians manipulate both sides of the fence in grand style in order to meet their predetermined end. Regardless of party affiliation, each soon forgets promises made during election year campaigning. These men of little honor all pursue the same object. Over a period of many decades, it has become quite obvious to even the most ardent believers in our institutions that even with all attempt at restraint and through the changing faces of the election process, there exists a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object, a design to reduce the American people under absolute despotism, a much proclaimed New World Order. Many arguments have been lodged against these abuses, but by now, most free-thinking men and women realize the futility of arguing any point of law with a king who presumes to write the law. Consider and study all of the executive orders and presidential directives which have been issued these past three decades, and you'll not only agree with the last statement, you'll begin to ask, why do we even have a Congress? The answer simply is pretense. For no matter how compelling the argument, no matter what legal, jurisdictional, or constitutional foundation upon which a case is constructed, it can be altered, abolished, or nullified by the next stroke of his pen if he finds it disagreeable. American government today exhibits the character of such a king. Yet more important than the changing of our laws, many realize that while making any attempt at legal defense or petition for redress, we are forced to make our presentation before people holding limited knowledge or concern for constitutional law at best, and utter in complete disdain for it at worst. If you believe that this is not so, then ask why they are now enforcing illegal and unconstitutional measures against us. One now begins to understand the futility of attempting to stop government abuses by references to the Constitution, the law of the land. As Thomas Paine stated in his pamphlet, Common Sense,
"Government, even in its best state, is but a necessary evil, in its worst state an intolerable one. For when we suffer, or are exposed to the same miseries by a government which we might expect in a country without a government, our calamity is heightened by reflecting that we furnish the means by which we suffer."
I submit to you, my friends, that this state of affairs is no longer tolerable.
Your adversaries are composed of wretches who laugh at the rights of humanity, who turn religion into derision, and would, for higher taxes, direct their swords against their leaders of their country. We have no other choice than independence.
Samuel Adams, 1776. If we now acknowledge the abuses of our government against us as being intolerable, and we also realize the futility of relying upon constitutional or legal authority for its control, we in fact find ourselves at a crucial point of decision. And the time to decide is now. For if we admit that there is no hope other than through divine intervention, and that we can in fact not prevail under law, yet we remain convinced that our cause is just and right, then we must either submit, abandoning that cause, or we must establish a just and right cause against the will and power of said abusive king. It now must be clearly understood that this is the point of departure beyond which, if we proceed, we no longer seek to allow government to work. We in fact seek to cast it off and begin anew.
I can conceive of a national destiny which meets the responsibilities of today and measures up to the possibilities of tomorrow. Behold a republic resting securely upon the mountain of eternal truth. A republic applying in practice and proclaiming to the world the self-evident propositions that all men are created equal, that they're endowed with inalienable rights, that governments are instituted among men to secure these rights, and that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. Behold a republic in which civil and religious liberty stimulate all to earnest endeavor, and in which the law restrains every hand uplifted for a neighbor's injury. A republic in which every citizen is a sovereign, but in which no one cares to wear a crown. Behold a republic standing erect while empires all around are bowed beneath the weight of their own armaments. A republic whose flag is love, while other flags are only fear.
William Jennings Bryant, Indiana, 1923. Having now arrived at such an ominous crossroads, laden with such grave implication and consequence, we must be clear of both heart and mind the exact nature of our beliefs. We can no longer proceed on our journey based upon the feelings of right or wrong, patriotism or Americanism, the theory of this government or that, no matter how strongly we feel. No matter how long or dearly held, each must now have a clear and distinct picture as to what that just and right cause is, and most importantly, which course to follow. Once again, Thomas Paine.
He whose heart is firm and with conscience approves his conduct will pursue his principles unto death. My own line of reason to myself is as straight and clear as a ray of light.
Firmness of heart and clearness of mind and purpose are essential if we are to withstand the trials which we'll face ahead. In order to support our course of action, there are mountains of volumes on patriotism and right available to all of us. We have multitudes of live radio and television broadcasts, both nationally and internationally, which will help teach us right from wrong, left from right. The Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, all of which can guide, animate, and inspire us. But frankly, when our world is shaken and shattered, it will be a single rock on which we place our feet that will be there to support us. Therefore, we must choose this rock wisely and plant our feet firmly upon it. We, each one of us, must know and understand our reasons and be willing and able to act upon them without hesitation whatsoever, and be prepared to communicate to the world, to anyone, at any time. In 1995, an atheist claimed that the early presidents and patriots were generally deists or Unitarians, rejecting the divinity of Jesus and the relevance of the Holy Bible. The writer of the article, published in the Los Angeles Times, would have us believe that our founding fathers and early patriots of this nation did not envision a Christian nation. This is a classic example of revisionist history by those who have little appreciation of said history, and in fact would deny us our American heritage. Stephen Morris, a member of Atheists United and a professor at Los Angeles Harbor College, has referred to the faith of our founders as an Orwellian revision by the Christian right. In his article, Mr. Morris harshly set the tone for his reasoning by referencing the Christian right, a term used by the non-Christian left to refer disparagingly to Christian patriots who believe in our Christian heritage, in moral absolutes, in our Constitution, and in the sovereignty of these United States. He follows these statements by claiming that the Christian right is trying to rewrite the history of this nation and to force its view of religion upon others. Both statements, which of course are truly revisionist. The so-called Christian right is certainly not attempting to rewrite history, but in fact trying to reclaim that which has been rewritten by humanists, atheists, socialists, and globalists, all who control education, religion, government, and the media. In other words, those who oppose our American heritage of Christianity. The views on the faith of our fathers have been well documented and substantiated over these past 2+ centuries. Consider the following as you contemplate the future of this once moral and Christian nation. For before we can prepare for the future, we must first understand the past. The Founding Fathers generally considered religion a very private matter. They did not go around proclaiming their religion. However, they did live it. George Washington never denied being a Christian. He not only prayed on a regular basis for his soldiers and country, but provided chaplains of many denominations for his army and required his officers and soldiers to attend services. Does this sound like a deist leader? In an order to his chaplains dated July 9th of 1776, he stated, "The general hopes and trusts that every officer and man will endeavor so to live and act as becomes a Christian soldier." On May the 12th of 1779, speaking to the chiefs of the Delaware Indians, Washington stated, "You will do well to wish to learn our ways of life, and above all, the religion of Jesus Christ." Upon taking the office of presidency 10 years later, Washington added the words, "So help me God," to the oath of office, and began a tradition which stands today, over 200 years later. He further stated, "It is impossible to rightly govern the world without God in the Bible." Our second president, according to the author, was opposed to all religion. Now, this statement, of course, is a purely revisionist falsehood. John Adams believed that republican institutions could only flourish among virtuous people and stated, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate for the government of any other." Adams, in fact, believed that the nation should be governed by the Bible and declared that the clergy had a duty to preach on social and political issues as they drew their inspiration and principles from the Word of God. In July of 1796, Adams stated, "The Christian religion is, above all the religions that ever prevailed or existed in ancient or modern times, the religion of wisdom, virtue, equity, and humanity. It is resignation to God. It is goodness itself to man." And in his inaugural address as president, Adams declared, "And may that being who is supreme over all, the patron of order, the fountain of justice, and the protector in all ages of the world of virtuous liberty, continue his blessings upon this nation." Thomas Jefferson, our third president, not only read the Bible, but he in fact studied it. After the death of his daughter, he stayed in his room for a considerable period of time with a Bible in hand. Once president, he stated, "The Christian religion, when divested of the rags in which the clergy have enveloped it, is a religion of all others most friendly to liberty, science, and the freest expansions of the human mind. James Madison, our fourth president, wanted the Christian religion to flourish in its purity, free from corruption. Madison, in fact, prepared the first draft of the First Amendment of our Constitution, allowing for the provision for religious liberty. He wrote, "Before any man can be considered as a member of civil society, he must be considered as a member of the governor of the universe." Madison considered belief in a God all-powerful, wise, and good essential to a moral order of the world. On June 28, 1787, the Constitutional Congress was foundering, and Ben Franklin called for prayer for unification, wherein he stated, "I have lived a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured in the sacred writings that, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that builds it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel." Franklin further expressed his belief that the convention had been guided by God in producing that constitution. Contrary to the distorted views of many in this nation today, the founding fathers did not reject the relevance of the Bible nor Christianity. In fact, they embraced it. They were students of the Bible. They quoted from it and made continual reference to it. Most believed in the fundamental principles of Orthodox Christianity. Yet those few who had reservations about certain doctrines recognized the positive influence of the Christian religion.
"Let us forget popular fears, from whatever quarter they may spring. Let us go to the limpid fountain of unadulterated patriotism, and performing a solemn lustration, return divested of all selfish, sinister, and sordid impurities, and think alone of our God, our country, our consciousness, and our glorious republic, a republic without which we shall be torn into hostile fragments, and sooner or later become the victims of military despotism or foreign domination. Let us look to our country and our cause, elevate ourselves to the dignity of pure and disinterested patriots, and save our country from all impending dangers." Henry Clay, Washington, D.C., 1850. Our founding fathers realized that the only way a free society can exist is among a highly religious and moral people. Biblical principles inspired the concepts of civil government in our Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Our founding fathers did not keep religion at a distance from government, yet kept government from interfering with religion in general, and Christianity in particular, as government seems to do today. For them, this hostility would have been offensive. Let us return to the wisdom and the ways of our forefathers.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The Union is in danger. It is that while the people sleep, politicians and philanthropists of the legislative hall, the stump and the press, will talk and write us out of our union. Yes, while you sleep, while the merchant is loading his ships and the farmer is gathering his harvest and the music of the hammer and shuttle wake around, and we are all steeped in the enjoyment of that vast and various good which a government places within our reach. There are influences that never sleep, and which are creating and diffusing a public opinion in whose hot and poisoned breath, before we yet perceive our evil plight, this union may melt as frostwork in the sun. Rufus Choate, Boston, Massachusetts, 1850. For all men, but more uniquely for Americans, there is and can only be one foundation, one rock upon which to stand in these matters. For Americans, because this was the single principle cited by our founders as being the basis for all legitimate government, no other principle can withstand its rightness nor almighty power. This principle was most eloquently stated by Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of those ends. It is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government.
The Declaration of Independence is a step from which there is no retreat, that unless victory is won, slavery will be the price for failure.
Samuel Adams, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, August 1776. This principle of Creator-endowed unalienable rights can be the only rock upon which we stand, one nation, under God, just as it was the foundation upon which this nation was built. Although Jefferson's words will sound familiar to most of us, few truly grasp the meanings or truth expressed by them. To many Americans, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, along with its Bill of Rights, are nothing more than archaic documents written by out-of-step historical figures who offer no foundation for modern society and are just pieces of paper housed under ultraviolet protected glass somewhere in the Smithsonian Institute. All of the forementioned are true, but one. Each of these documents, and collectively, provide the only foundation necessary for the true and just form of government offered to us by the Almighty God through His messengers, our founding fathers. Oh, their meanings were very specific and crystal clear. It is, in fact, self-evident to any willing to consider them. The applications were, and are, quite broad, powerful, and fundamental to the lifeblood of this great republic if we are to survive. Consider the words of Jefferson and the other authors of that declaration carefully, and understand them well, for we pass this way but once, my friends. The principles and ideals of this single revolutionary document form the only foundation and authority of American government. We had better learn this fact well, and we had better learn it quickly. We hold these truths to be self-evident. That is, the things to follow need no legal interpretation or elaboration, being self-evident to all thinking men. That all men are created equal. Most modern attention has been paid to the equal status of men, and usually for political gain, but the actual emphasis, as used by the founders, was on the recognition of the created status of man, explicit recognition of a creator. That they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. This is recognition that the creator grants rights to individual men. No other source of any right is acknowledged. Further, the rights so endowed are not alienable by other men acting individually or as any organized body without qualification. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. Note carefully the sole legitimate function of governments is to secure the pre-existing rights of the individual which were endowed by the Creator. No other function of government is mentioned, and no rights are granted by government. Deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, legitimate government has no just authority other than that granted by the governed. Importantly, this consent cannot mean only the consent of the majority, as in a democracy, for then the unalienable rights of all others could be subjugated to the will of the majority and would thus not be unalienable. Consent must be as individual as the rights themselves, otherwise they are not rights. So long as any individual does not attempt to materially deny such rights to others, government to which he has not consented can have no just claim upon him. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. Because all governmental authority originates in the people, the people have the right to reclaim that authority if government causes or allows interference with those rights, which it is founded to protect. Government never has the power to abolish rights, but when it tries to do so, men have the right to abolish government. Again, this right exists with each created individual, not in the will of the majority.
There is embedded in our Constitution the vital principles of the American system of liberty. That system is based upon certain unalienable freedoms and protections which not even the government may infringe and which we call the Bill of Rights. It does not require a lawyer to interpret those provisions. They are as clear as the Ten Commandments. Herein are the invincible sentinels which guard the door of every home from invasion of coercion, of intimidation and fear. The Bill of Rights is the expression of the spirit of men who would be forever free.
Herbert Hoover, San Diego, California, September 1935. With a simple yet basic education of the Constitution, understand that it remains subordinate to the principles of the Declaration of Independence. The Constitution merely sets forth the proposed mechanism for meeting the stated goals of securing and preserving the pre-existing unalienable rights of the people. All rights are in fact granted by the Creator. There is no such thing as a constitutional right. There are only constitutionally protected rights, endowed by the Creator and already belonging to the people. Either our rights are granted by our Creator and are unalienable by other men, or they are subject to amendment or recall by man. There can be no alternative. There are those who avow disbelief in a Creator God, but I strongly urge them to consider what dangerous ground that is to walk. Radio commentator William Cooper once stated, "Whether you believe in God or not, whether you believe in a Creator or not, you had better start, for without a Creator, without Creator-endowed unalienable rights, you are nothing. This nation is nothing. The Constitution is nothing. The Declaration of Independence is nothing. Our forefathers were wackos, and this great nation with the freedom and liberties and opportunities that come with it will crumble around your feet. I submit there is a Creator, and that Creator has given man unalienable rights that set men free for the first time in history of the world. For that is the cornerstone, that is the foundation upon which the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, and this nation rests, and without it, it will all crumble to nothing. It is precisely the loss or abandonment of this valuable cornerstone which has caused the crumbling of our nation today."
I agree to this Constitution with all its faults, if they are such,
Because I think a general government necessary for us. And there is no form of government but what may be a blessing to the people if well administered. And I believe further that this is likely to be well administered for a course of years and can only end in despotism as other forms have done before it, when the people shall become so corrupted as to need despotic government being capable of any other. Alexander Hamilton, Poughkeepsie, New York, 1787. I ask the question, if our nation was founded on so simple and solid a foundation, how is it that we have strayed so far from that great beginning? At this point, it is important not just to understand this question, but to understand that in fact there is an answer, that this has not just happened, and that the cause is simple and quite easy to understand. We can better understand what we have lost when we realize that the story of mankind has been a perpetual struggle to be free, free from the coercion of other men, men who call themselves the government. Throughout history, man's freedom has remained conspicuously absent, no matter under what or under whose authority. The pharaohs, the emperors, the kings, socialism, communism, fascism, or the People's Republic of whatever, it always added up to a singular fact: control of the many by the very few. The end result was always the same: stagnation, poverty, suppression of creativity, and the loss of human dignity. Sometime over 200 years ago, however, the real miracle of history took place when a small group of men, through divine guidance, formed a government which has been the beacon of the entire world ever since, a government which was formed to prevent man from having powers over us. All previous governments from the beginning of time had assumed all powers to control the people. America's great gift to mankind was the idea that we are endowed by our Creator with said unalienable rights. This was the single most important step forward for the good of mankind since the birth of Christ. Today, this God-given heritage is unrecognizable. Our freedoms have perished under the assaults of our natural enemy, government, too much of it, controlled by international elitists who seek their benefit in the control of all others. It has taken us less than 50 years to destroy what it took thousands of years to build, much of it due to the apathy of the American citizen who has basically had it so good that he never noticed the temperature being turned up in the pots of the cannibals. If we fully recognize these facts, perhaps our anger directed at those responsible will motivate us to reestablish those foundations where political motivations have failed.
The laws of nature are the laws of God, whose authority can be superseded by no power on earth.
George Mason, June 1776. Ask yourself this question. Why should this American government, which was founded only to preserve creator-endowed rights, enforce so strongly the exclusion of teaching of the creation in our educational system and the exclusion of a creator God from public life? This cannot be. At the very moment that our government denied the creator, it ceased to have the authority to govern. Generations of free men have now been made to forget their Creator, and as a result, have voluntarily given up, unknowingly, those important Creator-endowed rights. In doing so, we have also given up the prosperity, the power, and the wealth which resulted from their exercise to these slave masters. Because of revisionist history, we have become completely confused and defenseless against these usurpations of creator-endowed rights. If you feel confusion or think this an abstract or religious ideal, it is probably due more to these manipulations than to your own well-thought-out conclusions. Please consider what we have lost, or rather what has been stolen from us by these simple omissions from our education. These, in fact, are the reasons for the effort over the years to remove prayer and the concept of a creator God from the king's educational system. This was the single concept which was the strength of this nation of free men, and in order to be brought into the bondage of arbitrary government once again, we had to be stripped of the meaningful concept of the Creator God. The principle, my friends, is oh so simple. If there is no Creator, then there can be no Creator-endowed rights. And the only rights that could be recognized would be those granted by men. It is these base men who have taken upon themselves the role of kings, who are once again free to govern by their own means, without the restraints held so dear by our founders. These kings know full well the power of these principles, yet do not want us to know them.
I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
We have been taught by this same educational system that our form of government is a democracy, which it is not. Toward an end, we are continually told that our most valuable right and solemn obligation is to vote, to participate in this system. And most people now believe it, and worse, truly believe that their votes make a difference. We have also come to believe that those who choose not to vote have no right to complain about said abuses. So we participate, candidate after candidate, issue after issue. We expend our energies, our resources, and time like rats in a maze, hoping and praying that the next turn of the voting lever will make a difference. But each election day outcome is no different than the previous. And because of it, no real changes ever take place, forcing us into apathy along with the rest of our fellow rats. Under these conditions, the value of absolute, unalienable rights quickly becomes apparent, as does the difference between men and rats. We have been taught that majority rule is an American tradition, and that our electoral process constitute majority rule. But in most elections, the majority of the people do not vote. Instead of counting this as rejection of all the ballot choices, once again the media cries voter apathy. But consider one of America's greatest icons, the good sheriff who faces down a lynch mob bent upon violence. Here is that principle of right. And even the single man who recognizes it must prevail against the will of the majority. This is the true heritage of America. Under the American Republic, founded upon the ideology of strictly limited powers of government, the most significant right of the people is their right to not participate and yet to remain secure in their liberties and their possessions. This is, in fact, the seldom understood difference between our republic and a democracy. You see, in a democracy, all things are subject to the will of the voters. There are no absolutes. And who can ever best work the crowd can most effectively govern. Under our republic, the rights of the individual are secure and of primary importance, requiring no participation on the part of the individual. The power of government is strictly limited. By this delusion of democracy, we have confirmed our consent each time we voted, and have become conditioned to accept government's authority to commit the abuses in excess which we witness. By this continued participation, we submit to every measure imposed and restrain ourselves from meaningful opposition, being ever hopeful that the next election will make a real difference. By these means, the king has reclaimed his throne. It has been by design, by degrees, and by our consent that we have surrendered our rights. We have been seduced into ceasing from the exercise of those rights voluntarily. Thus, our consent was obtained fraudulently by the calculated concealment of the knowledge of those rights and of their source and value. We must fully understand these things and convince ourselves once and for always of the rightness and power of this principle of creator-endowed unalienable rights.
Will the people suffer themselves to be stripped of their privileges? The states can never lose their powers until the whole people of the United States are robbed of their liberties.
Alexander Hamilton, 1787. The questions now must be posed. How do we dethrone these would-be kings and rulers and reclaim our nation and our rights? Remember, the only just power that government wields is derived from the consent of the governed, and because the loss of right and all attendant abuses have been done under the auspices of our consent, we must rescind our consent to be so governed. Secondly, rights previously surrendered must be reclaimed. Rights thus reclaimed to have effect must then be exercised. These require risk on the part of each individual. However, there is no more effective strategy. If it is dearness only that gives everything its value, then we must decide what cost would be deemed too dear to free ourselves and those generations yet unborn from certain and absolute slavery. Ill-gotten consent must be withdrawn on the basis that consent granted without full knowledge or consent obtained by deception is not consent at all. This does not require immediate action on the part of the individual, just the settling in one's own mind of his relationship to his creator, his fellow man, and to their government. It is nothing more than to exercise the most basic of our rights, the right to not participate and to no longer be bound by the actions of those who do.
Idle industries have cast workers into unemployment, human misery, and personal indignity. Those who do work are denied a fair return for their labor by a tax system which penalizes successful achievement and keeps us from maintaining full productivity. But great as our tax burden is, it has not kept pace with public spending. For decades, we have piled deficit upon deficit, mortgaging our future and our children's future for the temporary convenience of the present. To continue this long trend is to guarantee tremendous social, cultural, political, and economic upheavals. You and I, as individuals, can, by borrowing, live beyond our means, but for only a limited period of time. Why then should we think that collectively, as a nation, we're not bound by that same limitation? We must act today in order to preserve tomorrow. And let there be no misunderstanding. We're going to begin to act beginning today. The economic ills we suffer have come upon us over several decades. They will not go away in days, weeks, or months, but they will go away. They will go away because we, as Americans, have the capacity now, as we've had in the past, to do whatever needs to be done to preserve this last and greatest bastion of freedom. In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
The most important act of withdrawing one's consent to be so governed is to consciously set your mind to it. The filings of legal documents, claims of jurisdictions and/or citizenship, etc., can be performed, having as their stated purpose the reclaiming of those rights and sovereignty. Remember, however, most of these are designed to give the individual some perceived security under the law. To obtain the king's permission to be sovereign, do not allow yourself to become entangled in a legal wrestling match as to which government agency does or does not have jurisdiction over us. It must be the unqualified assertion that none have jurisdiction unless we grant it, and we do not grant it. All legal arguments are moot and must be avoided, for if we choose to look to the law for our justification, we cease to seek our right. We seek the permission of the king once more. Therefore, the most effective strategy is to settle matters within one's own mind and subsequently conduct ourselves accordingly. We must accustom ourselves to thinking and acting on this basis. If the king objects, let him come to you, and be prepared to withstand him for your part. In some of the most oppressed nations on earth, voting is mandatory. If this were not so, no legitimate authority could be claimed by those governments, and without the hope provided by the vote of the people, they might rebel. How often have we felt that we had little choice in an election and chose to vote for the evil of the lessers? What you have done, in fact, is consented to be governed by that acknowledged evil. If you were playing a card game and discovered that it was rigged against you, complaining while you continued to play would be insufficient. You must leave the table. In this nation, withdrawal of consent is to largely ignore the popular political debate as having no consequence, and certainly never to participate in it, never to vote, and not to be bound in any way by the outcome of any election. This will be a rethinking and a repudiation of democracy, and will likely be most difficult for those who thought democracy to be the foundation of our liberties. Withdrawal in this manner is not lawlessness, as some will claim. For when one claims his creator-endowed rights, he or she also submits to the creator's laws for all men, what the founders called natural law. In 1788, James Madison stated that we have staked the future upon the capacity of each and all of us to govern ourselves, to sustain ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God. In laying claim to the rights endowed by him, we also assume the responsibility of conducting ourselves according to his laws, including that of sustaining ourselves materially according to his laws. These are not matters to be trifled with, my friends, as many who have taken these actions have soon learned.